Money Psychology. Money Psychology.
Every time you reach for your wallet, check your bank balance, or make a financial decision, you're not just dealing with money. You're reliving every money lesson, fear, and belief you absorbed before you were old enough to understand what any of it meant. I'm Elliot Graves, and this is Money Psychology, where we explore how your earliest financial experiences created the money mindset that controls your financial life today. Welcome to Money Psychology. Today, we're diving into a topic that, well, it's one of those things that operates just beneath the surface, but has, I think, a profound impact on our financial lives. For me personally, I've always been fascinated by the invisible scripts that guide our decisions. We talk about family, about society, but what about the divine? What about our deepest spiritual beliefs?
Exactly.
It's a conversation I've been wanting to have for a long time. I grew up in a household where faith and finance were, you know, completely separate conversations. One was for Sunday, the other was for the kitchen table. But as I've gotten older, I've seen how deeply intertwined they really are, not just for me, but for so many people. It's a powerful, often unspoken, influence, which brings us to the central question we want to explore today. A question for everyone listening. What if the way you connect to something bigger than yourself, whether you call it God, the universe, or just your inner compass, is secretly shaping every single dollar you spend, save, and give away? That's the heart of it. We're calling this episode the Financial Kaleidoscope because we want to look at how our spiritual and religious beliefs act as these intricate lenses that color our entire perception of money. It's going to be a fascinating exploration. We'll be looking at everything from the ancient teachings of major world religions on wealth and charity to the more modern, personal spiritualities that guide so many of us today. We're hoping to uncover how these deep-rooted values can be the source of our greatest financial strengths or our most challenging money blocks. And we promise, this isn't just a theoretical discussion. We're going to get into personal stories, hard research, and practical insights that might just change the way you look at your bank account forever. So, get comfortable, because we're about to open a door that connects the sacred to the spreadsheet. And you know, when you say that, connecting the sacred to the spreadsheet, it brings up this immediate, almost visceral question for me. Where do these sacred ideas even come from? I mean, before they're a doctrine or a rule, they're just a story. A powerful foundational story. A myth, in the classical sense. Not as in a falsehood, but as a framework for understanding the world. Precisely. I was reading Joseph Campbell, and he had this line that just floored me. He said, "Mythology is often thought of as other people's religions." And that just clicks, doesn't it? My belief is faith, your belief is mythology. It does. And sociologically, a myth is just defined as a story that is important for the group, whether or not it's, you know, provably true. The truth of it isn't the point. The function of it is the point. So, let's bring that down to the kitchen table. Forget ancient Greece for a second. What about the family that has a foundational myth that debt is a moral failing?
Oh, that's a big one.
It's huge. It might have started with a grandparent who lost everything in a depression. Their story becomes a kind of sacred text for that family. It's not in the Bible or the Quran, but it's preached with the same fervor. And it dictates every financial decision for generations. It's like that grandparent becomes the charismatic prophet of the family's financial belief system. The text we were looking at mentioned that many world religions began as these revitalization movements, sparked by a single charismatic figure. Yes, it's the same pattern, just on a micro scale. That one person's intense experience, their revelation about the evils of debt, becomes institutionalized. It becomes how we, the Jones family, handle money. And then it becomes a core part of the family identity. It's a social structure. Adherence to that belief, "we don't borrow money," is a sign of membership. To go out and get a mortgage, it's not just a financial choice. It's a kind of heresy. You're breaking with the faith. you're questioning the foundational story. And that can feel so incredibly isolating. It's not just about the numbers on a loan application. It's about potentially being cast out of your tribe. Which explains why these beliefs are so persistent, even when they might not be serving the individual anymore. The emotional and social cost of challenging the myth can feel way higher than the financial cost of sticking with it.
Yeah. And what about the flip side? The myth of, say, the prosperity gospel that has become so prominent. The belief that financial blessing is a direct sign of divine favor. That's a fascinating one because it directly links spiritual worthiness with material wealth. It's not a subtle undercurrent. It's the main point. The practice, giving to the church, tithing, is explicitly tied to the belief that you will receive a multiplied financial return. It completely reframes the act of giving. It's no longer just charity. It's an investment. A spiritual one, sure, but the language is very much one of transaction with the divine. And you can see the appeal. It offers a sense of control and a direct answer to financial anxiety. The text mentions that one of the core functions of religion is to help us deal with problems that are significant, persistent, and intolerable. Financial insecurity is right at the top of that list for so many people. And that word you used, intolerable, that's the key, isn't it? Financial precarity feels so deeply, fundamentally intolerable that we will grasp for any system that promises a sense of agency, a formula. If I do A and B, then C, financial security, is guaranteed. It's an incredibly powerful emotional anesthetic. It is. It takes this chaotic, often unjust economic world and reframes it as a direct, personal relationship. The problem isn't the system. It's not bad luck. It's not a predatory lender. The problem, and therefore the solution, is located entirely within your spiritual practice. But what happens when the formula fails? When you tithe faithfully, you pray, you do everything you're told, and you're still facing eviction. Where does that psychic pain go? Well, that's the insidious genius of these closed-loop belief systems. The failure is never attributed to the system itself. It's turned back on the individual. The message becomes, your blessing is delayed because your faith isn't strong enough, or you have some hidden sin. The formula wasn't wrong. You executed it improperly. Oh, that's just brutal. It's a psychological trap. Because the only solution offered is to double down. To give more, pray harder, believe more fervently. It creates a cycle of shame and escalating commitment. And it's reinforced by the social structure. Everyone around you in that community is celebrating their supposed blessings. The new car, the promotion, they're presented as evidence that the system works. So if it's not working for you, the silence can be deafening. You're not just failing financially, you're failing spiritually in a very public way. So, the fear of questioning the belief isn't just about losing faith in a divine contract. It's about losing your entire community, your support system, the very people who are supposed to be there for you. It becomes an instrument for maintaining the cohesion of the group. The ancient Romans understood this perfectly. The historian Polybius talked about superstition being used as a tool to bind the empire together. It's the same principle. Shared belief, shared rituals, shared outcomes. It creates a powerful in-group, but it also creates a terrifying out-group, which you can be cast into just by admitting doubt or failure. It's one thing to have a family myth about not taking on debt. It's another thing entirely when your eternal salvation and your entire social world are tied to your net worth. And that's where the line starts to blur between faith and, well, something else. The Catholic Church has this really interesting definition of superstition. It's not just about black cats or walking under ladders. They define it as attributing an importance in some way magical to certain practices, attributing the efficacy of prayers to their mere external performance apart from the interior disposition. Wow. So the act of writing the check becomes a kind of magic spell, divorced from the actual feeling or intent behind it. The transaction itself is where the power lies, precisely. It becomes a deviation, as they put it. And when you look at it through that lens, you start to see how that magical thinking isn't just confined to a few specific churches. We all do it to some extent. The lucky interview suit, the refusal to invest in a certain stock because the last one from that sector tanked, we're all trying to find patterns and exert control over the uncontrollable. It's so true. And it's almost comforting in a strange way to think of it like that. The person wearing the lucky interview suit and the person writing a tithe check are, at a fundamental level, doing the same thing. They're both performing an external act to try and influence an outcome they can't control. The stakes are just wildly different. The scale is different, but the psychological mechanism is identical. It's a ritual to manage anxiety. And I think that's maybe the biggest takeaway for me from this whole conversation. We've talked about these big, sweeping belief systems, family myths, religious doctrines, but it all comes back to this very personal, very human need to feel safe and in control in a world that often offers neither. And to feel like there's a reason for things, that it's not all just random. If I lose my job, it's not because of a corporate merger I have no say in. It's because my faith wavered. That's a painful story, but for some, it's less terrifying than the story of pure, indifferent chaos.
Yeah.
It's choosing a difficult narrative over no narrative at all. But I guess the lingering question for me, and probably for a lot of people listening, is, so what do we do? If we recognize these scripts running in our own heads, these little superstitions, or these massive inherited financial doctrines, how do we, what, get rid of them? I don't think you can. I really don't. I think trying to just erase them is like trying to not think about a pink elephant. My sense is that the work isn't erasure, it's awareness. It's learning to ask, in the moment you're about to make a decision, why am I doing this? Is this choice coming from a place of genuine value, like generosity or prudence, or is it coming from a place of fear? Am I trying to perform a magic spell to ward off uncertainty? So, it's about interrogating the belief's function in that moment. Exactly. Is its function to connect you to your values, or is its function to anesthetize your anxiety? Because one leads to freedom, and the other, well, the other leads to that cycle of shame and escalating commitment we talked about. I see that. I do, but I also wonder if there's a third path. Not just accepting or interrogating, but integrating. Taking these powerful traditions, these deep-seated beliefs that offer so much in terms of community and meaning, and consciously reshaping them. Saying, I will take the part of my faith that encourages radical generosity, but I will leave behind the part that equates net worth with self-worth. It's not a rejection, it's a personal reformation. A conscious curation of your own belief system. I like that. It's less about being a passive recipient of these scripts, and more about becoming the active editor. You're acknowledging the power of the original text, but you're also giving yourself permission to write in the margins. And maybe that's the ultimate financial and spiritual goal, to look at your money, at your life, through that kaleidoscope we mentioned at the beginning, but to understand that you're the one holding it. You can turn the lens. You can shift the pieces. The pattern doesn't have to be fixed. You get to decide what beautiful, meaningful shape it takes. The next time you make a financial decision that surprises you, whether it's an impulsive purchase or an overly cautious investment choice, ask yourself, whose voice am I hearing? And what childhood memory might be driving this choice? Understanding your money psychology doesn't guarantee better financial decisions, but it's the first step toward making choices based on your current reality rather than your childhood fears and dreams.